There's a gleam of blue from a cold night's moon. Just a touch too soon. Two deliverances. That's the hotel year. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. Just a touch away for the second time for Bowden Francis yesterday. He took a no-hitter into the ninth inning for the second time this year, the second time this month, the second time in 11 career starts. Ridiculous, ridiculous stretch of pitching for Bowden Francis continued last night. Now, the Jays lost that game. Bowden Francis did surrender a leadoff home run in the ninth to Francisco Lindor, the exact same ending as when he took a no-hitter into the ninth against Taylor Ward and the Angels. Underneath that, though, Bowden Francis, terrific, and terrific in a different style. He only had one strikeout, didn't have a ton of his swing and miss stuff. Mentioned after the game that he had been feeling a little fatigued, and by the end of the game, when, you know, you're deep into the 100 pitches, you're just kind of, hey, they've been getting bad contact against the fastball, even with the fastball down a tick or two. Let's just groove it. Let's just force them to do something with it. And it worked. In the eighth inning, he only needed six pitches to get out of the inning because, again, the Mets were a weak contact factory against that deceptive fastball and the splitter combo. There were times where Bowden Francis is even signaling to his catcher with his glove, and it kind of gives away the pitch, and the Mets still couldn't do anything with it. This has been the story of the last six starts, really, for Bowden Francis. The progress started before that, but it's been over these last six starts where things have really clicked. He has, and this is a stat from our pal Chris Black, who is going to have a Bowden Francis thread up on Twitter at Down to Black any minute now, so go check that out during a commercial break. Over his last six starts, Bowden Francis has allowed 0.4 base runners per inning, so his whip, his walks and hits per innings pitch. That is the lowest rate of base runners over a six-start stretch in the history of baseball. Jacob deGrom had the previous best in 2021. So underneath that, you know, yeah, then you got to go back to Grover Alexander in 1915. Bowden Francis, 0.4 base runners per inning over the last six starts. He has walked just six batters over his last 54 innings. And yeah, there wasn't a ton of swing and miss yesterday, but the Mets absolutely could not square up anything that Bowden Francis was offering. Now, Francisco Lindor did end it in the ninth. Didn't appreciate my close personal friend Bad Bunny posting highlights of that. Obviously, Francisco Lindor with the Puerto Rican heritage there, and Bad Bunny being, I was going to say a Mets fan. He's also a Yankees fan. He's also a bit of a Jays fan. Anyway, don't need to twist the knife there, Benito. Anyway, it didn't work out. And then once Bowden Francis came out of the game after surrendering that home run to Francisco Lindor, everything fell apart. Chad Green and Yenesis Cabrera combined to make the final score 6-2 instead of 1-1, which it was when Bowden Francis leaves. So he doesn't get the W, doesn't get much run support, doesn't get help from his bullpen there. But man, what a stretch of pitching from Bowden Francis. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it with our pal Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. She joins us now. Caitlin, good morning. How are we doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not Bowden Francis good, but I'm feeling pretty good today. I've read your story, but can you take us inside, you know, the clubhouse, the press conference room after last night's game, where, like, is everyone in as disbelief as, like, even if you're a Bowden Francis believer, big picture, there has to be an element of, wow, with this guy, the way he's pitching right now. Was that kind of the sense after the game?
Yeah, I know. It's funny. Like, I remember turning to, my friend and yours, Ian Harrison, because I sit beside him in the press box, probably, like, in the fifth or so inning, and just saying to him, like, are we getting another, like, Bowden Francis near no hitter or no hitter? Like, is that happening again today? Like, it just kind of had that feeling, after 3-4 innings, which it was, after the game, I think that people were just more kind of surprised, or just there was, like, a feeling of, like, not just that it happened again, but that it ended in basically, like, the same way. Very similar. I think Taylor Ward's home run went the other way, it went center field, I think. But anyway, very, very similar way to end it. And yeah, I think there was just some, I don't know that there was disbelief that, like, Bowden Francis was, you know, very strong again on the mound. Like, everybody kind of got used to the way that he's pitching now. But I think, yes, the sentiment was, like, that was kind of weird that it happened again in a very similar way. I think John Schneider used the word, like, eerie or eerily similar. Outside of the strikeouts, which I think in against LA, he had a career-high 12. Yesterday, he only had one. But so it was a different way he went about it. But I mean, that just kind of speaks to the skill of Bowden Francis at this point, that, you know, he doesn't necessarily have to go out there and blow guys away and rack up strikeouts. He can, you know, just get guys off balance. He can force guys to just hit a lot of weak contact. So, you know, it's another layer to this Bowden Francis story where you're now seeing, okay, not only does he doesn't have to have necessarily his best stuff. I mean, he talks about being fatigued. He talked about knowing he was not going to be able to blow by guys yesterday, just kind of knowing he wasn't going to have that swing and miss stuff. But he still was able to masterfully, you know, cut up the Mets lineup. And that's a good lineup. I know they've been kind of slow offensively lately, but, you know, that's a very good lineup. And so, yeah, everybody's still kind of surprised, but also at the same time kind of used to getting these kind of performances from Bowden Francis now.
Yeah, how quick things have changed where this has become... No, I mean, obviously going for a no-hit bid is not normal, but I tweeted out yesterday, if you take away the Phillies game, which obviously you can't do, but for the purposes of this, in his last five starts, he has allowed only four hits the first two times through the order. Like, he is going, like, no-hit, one-hit, two-hit, through the sixth inning, like every time out, with, you know, again, with the exception of Kyle Schwarber, who absolutely tattooed him to start that game. It's been pretty good. And so last night, you know, one of the questions that obviously comes up on Twitter or in the press box or whatever, when he is at 100 pitches heading into the eighth, is how long is he going to be allowed to go? And it turns out that he only threw 111 pitches. He had gone into the 100 and teens the last time out. John Schneider said after the game, again, he was, even though Bowden Francis felt a little fatigued in that one and the velocity was down and stuff like that, the sense now is if this comes up again, whether it's Bowden Francis or someone else in future years, John Schneider's not going to get in the way of history. That's the read on this, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, unless, you know, someone is approaching, you know, 100 pitches in the sixth inning or something like that, where, you know, it's just you can't push them. But I think that, yes, John Schneider didn't want to get in the way of history. I also think Bowden Francis is very efficient. Eighth inning went a long way in helping him out. Like, he got two quick outs right away in the eighth, didn't throw a lot of pitches. And so that really helped him because, yes, he was over 100, I think, only threw a handful of pitches in that eighth. So I think he goes into the ninth at 108 and, yeah, ends at 111 or so. Overall, you know, not too many pitches, kind of in the same realm as he was last time, working with the extra day's rest. So he does probably have a little bit more leeway. The way that I read it was maybe like Pete Walker gets a little more nervous at these things, which maybe is understandable. He is the pitching coach, whereas John Schneider is the guy that's like, you know, I don't want to be the guy that's pulling him because he's the one that will get the booze, not Pete. So, yeah, I think overall, though, like now they're kind of getting used to this decision when it comes to Bowden. I mean, he's making it interesting for them. But, yeah, certainly it feels like, especially with the extra day's rest, there was some room to work with. It ended up not really mattering. And, you know, he got a chance at it. It didn't work out. But, yeah, it's, you know, it's been a kind of stressful couple games for the staff there. But, you know, it's been fun to watch.
So that's the staff side of it. What has Bowden's response to this been? I know he was, you know, after the first one, a little frustrated, but then kind of chuckled, had some fun with the Taylor Ward quote, the Gate 14 shirt and all that stuff. And he does it again yesterday. I know that the whole like marketing tagline with Bowden Francis is how even keeled and like kind of above the noise he is. But he's had two near misses at it now. How is he responding to this and processing this?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he still had a really good attitude of it. I mean, you saw when he came out of the game, he was still very appreciative of the crowd reception for him. I think John Schneider said when he came out of the game, when he took the ball from Bowden, Bowden was kind of like, we did it again, like, you know. So I think he had a good attitude towards it. After the game, he didn't seem down in it by any means. Obviously, like, a little bit disappointed that you get so close again and you get beat on a fastball. But he seemed to just be, like, really appreciative of it, sort of still kind of not satisfied, just in the sense that he is continuing to, like, want to go out there and prove to himself that he's a big league starter. He knows he's a big league starter, but sort of just, you know, continuing to go out there and show that he is one and can be relied upon. And I mean, someone asked him about, like, you know, what have you learned from these two near misses? And he kind of just talked about, like, you know, if it ever happens again, you know, maybe he's got to approach the ninth a little differently. Maybe he's got to not necessarily try to beat them with fastballs. Maybe he needs to mix in his off speed. You know, and it's funny to say, like, oh, next time it happens. But at this point, it's happened twice. So what's stopping it from happening again, right? So, yeah, it sounds like he's just been appreciative of these games, appreciating of the learning experience. He's also a guy that has often talked about, especially early in the year when he was really struggling, often talked about how much more you can learn in tough times than necessarily your successes. So I would think that he kind of just takes the attitude with that. And overall, you know, he might just be more disappointed that the Blue Jays didn't win the game as well.
Yeah, although, you know, big picture, you know, we can sit here and say the team obviously doesn't feel this way. It's not the end of the world for them to blow games like this. And as someone who would like for that Mets team to make the playoffs, I'm really not going to argue about it. So with Ben Francis, you know, he has talked about wanting to be a starter. John Schneider has talked about how he thinks, you know, mentality wise and then obviously physical profile wise, Bowden is kind of built to be a starter. Obviously nothing for 2025 is locked in now, but like each time this happens, we get a little bit more toward, yeah, Bowden's a part of this at least to start 2025. Like how close are we to, you know, again, it doesn't affect your offseason shopping. There is the Yari Allen, Jake Bloss question marks, all the guys who are injured, who would be the depth, et cetera, et cetera. But just the Bowden component, like how much closer do we keep inching here to, yeah, he's the fourth starter. It's not even that big a question mark anymore.
Yeah, I think we're really close. I mean, every time something like this has happened and you kind of ask John Schneider about it, I feel like his answer gets more and more definitive every single time. Like even a couple weeks ago asking him about Bowden Francis, and it's like, you know, we like what we've seen, we're really impressed with the adjustments that he's made and the evolution that he's shown, and we want to see him kind of finish out the season strong. And then, you know, yesterday asking John Schneider after the game you know, about this, how sustainable it is, and you know, he talks about how Bowden is doing everything you want in a starting pitcher. Like he is, you know, not resting on his successes. He's continuing to work all the things that you want to see from a starting pitcher. And he's doing those things. And so the way that they're talking about him right now is he is a starting pitcher. You know, he is someone that he's doing all the right things, all the things that we want to see. And so, I mean, I don't know that it's, you know, 100% he's in there, but he certainly is penciled in, I think, at this point. I think that he will have every opportunity to be the fourth starter. I think that he, you know, starts with a leg up on any of the competition. I think that, you know, his performance in spring will obviously help determine it, but I think that he's going to get the benefit of the doubt. I mean, he's probably only got, like, a couple more starts at this point, so you know, even if they didn't go that well, you know, it doesn't take a no-hitter into the ninth or the next two. I still think he's shown enough promise that the Blue Jays are going to want to see what he can do. And so, yeah, I think that, no, it doesn't necessarily completely alter the off-season plans, but I do think if you're the Blue Jays front office, you think, okay, we're feeling pretty good about four starters. You know, maybe we do move some money around. Maybe we do kick some more money to our bullpen budget or getting an extra bent batch or something like that. Just because I do think that their rotation and their starting pitching in general is probably where they have a bit of most depth and room to play with. And so I think Bowden's performance has kind of helped with that and maybe given them some room to consider other areas of the roster a little bit more.
Yeah, you know, it's certainly in a game like that, you think, well, wouldn't it be nice to have a bullpen behind Bowden Francis instead of wouldn't it be nice to have a starter to get you to Bowden Francis's two innings out of the bullpen? Caitlin, we don't need to talk about the bullpen too much other than Chad Green looked really, really good for a while. There were a lot of underlying red flags in his profile. Well, maybe not red flags, yellow flags, we'll say, in his profile that suggested he was overperforming a little bit. He's had like four of his last five outings have been really, really rough now. Is there much to make of that beyond the randomness of a bullpen and late in a season and things like that? Like, should there be some concern here about where Chad Green's at over the last couple of weeks?
Maybe mild concern. I'm not too worried. I think there's a few things. I think that Chad Green has pitched a lot. Maybe he's been overexposed a little bit. I don't necessarily know that he's a closer. I think he's a really good pitcher. He's a really good, setup guy. I think that he has proven over his long career that he is a reliable arm out of the bullpen. So, saying he might not be a closer type, I'm not trying to disparage him whatsoever. I think that he's very, very good at what he's done over the course of his career, which I think more naturally is being a seventh or eighth inning guy. And so I just think that he's probably just been overworked, overexposed a little bit. Maybe he's not necessarily built for those last three outs. And I also think that probably this is the first full season back from surgery for him, right? So maybe that's a bit of a factor too. It is the end of the year. It's been a long year for the Blue Jays, for the bullpen especially. So I think that I'm not too concerned. I do think it's worth kind of wondering, did the Blue Jays miss an opportunity to trade him at the deadline when, the numbers looked really good. Maybe not so much the underlying numbers, but he can't go back now at this point. And so he's a guy that will help them next year in their bullpen, I think, probably more naturally in a role where he's starting at the ninth inning as opposed to pitching in the ninth inning. But I'm not too concerned about it. Maybe ask me next year in like May or June if things aren't going well. Maybe then it's more of a concern.
Yeah, it's on my radar because I started to feel a little bad at one point at the trade deadline. Like I had packed this guy's bags. And I was like, you know what? Like I like Chad Green. He's a good reliever. But if you can get something for him and use that $10.5 million for next year differently, maybe that was worth exploring. Who knows what the market was for him. Okay, Caitlin, on the offensive side, the Jays obviously didn't give Bowden Francis much run support, even though they're like quietly the best. Mike Petriello broke down on Blue Jays Central last night that the Jays have the best offense in baseball over the last 30 days, which doesn't feel right. But I guess suddenly you have all these left-handers and you actually get the platoon advantage and things like that. The other element for their offense is that they will probably get Bo Bichette back next week when they travel to Texas. He didn't play in the AAA game yesterday because he had done five innings in the field the day prior. He's expected to be back in there today. I know you wrote about this in your breakdown coming out of the weekend. Caitlin, what are you looking for from Bo Bichette when he comes back here for these final 2 weeks of the season?
I think most importantly, it's health. You're looking for him to look comfortable in the batter's box. You're looking for him to be comfortable, driving out of the box, running on the bases, sliding, and then obviously in the field as well, looking comfortable to, pivot and make all the necessary moves that you need to make. And so that's number one, underlying number one. You just want him to look healthy. And I think then performance comes after that. I think that, obviously he's not going to be able to, completely salvage the season in terms of his numbers. Like this is going to go down as, a career low year for him probably, or certainly of his career so far. And so I think that realistically, that's not going to change. This is going to be looked back at as a frustrating year for him, individually, as a team, all those things. But I think that if you can sort of just like look a little bit more like yourself, have a little bit of a nice run to end the season, rack up a few hits, get on base, look a little bit more like yourself, get a home run, you know what I mean? Like that has been one area where he really, didn't perform this year. And so I think that is probably what you're looking for. Just if there's any positive momentum that he can take into the off season, I think that that's only a good thing for him and the team. And first of all, it's going to be health. I think he's just going to be relieved to be back in the lineup looking like he can play without any limitation. Secondly, if he can have a couple nice at-bats or just feel like he's in a groove again or feel more like himself, I think that will go a long way into helping him, you know, go into the offseason very motivated for next year.
Yeah, and, you know, your first at-bat in late March next year isn't your first time facing real live game pitching in you know, 9 months or whatever it would have worked out to. Although the Jays don't have, you know, none of these games, they don't have a game left against the team that matters to the playoff race unless the Red Sox go on a run here. So maybe it's like a quad A kind of feel, but still better than nothing. Caitlin, with respect to that AAA team, I know that they're not going to give us answers on this, but the Jays have an off day today. They have another off day next week. They have another off day in the last week of the season. They could get away with only doing one of those bullpen days or six starter days once the rest of the way, and everyone would still be on extended rest the entire time. Given that Jake Blass has struggled so much in two of his last three AAA starts, are you starting to doubt at all that we see him make a cameo down the stretch here?
Yeah, I think I'm starting to doubt it. It's not. I think, like, earlier in the month and even after the trade, it felt like there was a lot of, like, we'd like to see him. Hopefully we see him at the major league level. And I feel like it wasn't that long ago that John Schneider was saying, like, you know, maybe Jake Blass will be our sixth starter, so to speak, or just see, you know, you can insert him in those opportunities where the Blue Jays would need an extra arm to give everybody extra rest. And it feels like now it's not so much. And, you know, I think the idea is that maybe they're working on things with Jake Blass, so maybe there is, you know, when you switch organizations, like, they get your eyes on you, and maybe they see something they like in one of your pitches, or they want you to try another pitch. So there's probably an adjustment period that he's going through right now. I think there's also probably an element of fatigue. It's been just a lot for him this year, going up through all the different levels, making his major league debut, getting traded, going to a new organization. So that in itself, I think, is a bit of a whirlwind, a lot to handle for a young pitcher. So I think there's maybe some element of fatigue happening as well. And so maybe the Blue Jays decide, you know, we don't need to push him. We'll see. I mean, I think there's an opportunity, maybe even like the last start of the year, where they could use him. But again, I don't know if you want a guy, if he's been struggling, to, you know, pitch the last game of the year and struggle and only, you know, pitch two innings or something like that and end the year not so great. So maybe it's better for him to just kind of close out the year at AAA. It's still been a good year for him overall. He makes his major league debut and all this kind of stuff. And just leave it be and just kind of go with who you have, Yarbrough or, you know, a bullpen day or something like that.
Yeah, or I don't know, one of the other AAA guys or whatever. There are a lot of arms down there that they could churn. Caitlin, before I let you go here, because the Jays aren't super competitive right now, you got to cover the Phillies side of the series the other week. You're also doing some of the power rankings over at The Athletic. Obviously, we would all prefer to be locked in on the Jays, you know, heading into the playoffs and be writing about that kind of stuff. You know, who should be the 26th man on the playoff roster, which starter should go to the bullpen and things like that. But has it been a little fun for you to get to take more of a national view the last little while in your role at The Athletic?
Yeah, I mean, I like going to the Philly side. It's always kind of interesting to see how other teams operate and just, you know, get to know other players and other managers and things like that. And so, yeah, when I was around the Phillies, it was like all this talk about guys that were sort of banged up but still wanting to play through it. I think that was the game that Bryce Harper got hit with a pitch, and he left the game. He's also been dealing with a nagging, you know, elbow wrist issue. Kyle Schwarber, I think, recently has been dealing with things, even though he keeps hitting home runs. And so, yeah, it was, you know, I remember that, not necessarily that exact storyline, but just those kinds of storylines where you're like debating on, you know, trying to rest guys, but also trying to push to win the division. The Phillies are like pretty much, you know, locked up to win that National League East division, but there's also the priority to maybe get the best record, so they have home field advantage for the postseason. And so balancing all those different things is certainly different different storylines that I'm working with on the Blue Jays, where it's like, you know, young players getting at bats and us wondering, like, you know, how many more times can Leo Jimenez get hit with a pitch? Like, those are some of the things we're talking about on the Toronto side.
That was in my notes to ask you about. The guy is like, had if we included his AAA stats, he's like close to what would be the Ty Francis record from last year. He's been hit by 28 pitches this year. It's ridiculous. But yeah, we can save that for another day, another story. Caitlin, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
Kayla McGrath of The Athletic, a lot of great Jays work up there. And yeah, chipped in on the Philly side. She's been helping do their power rankings as well. So a lot of great stuff from Caitlin. Always a lot of great stuff from The Athletic. Couple quick notes before we move on. Talked about Kevin Biggio a little bit yesterday because in Bobichet's first game, he grounded out and grounded into a double play to Kevin Biggio. Kevin Biggio then got called up to the Atlanta Braves last night. So he's now played for three major league teams and two AAA teams this year. The Braves obviously dealing with a boatload of injuries. There is Anthopoulos wasn't still here when the Jays drafted Kevin Biggio, but that was, you know, that was largely the remnants of his scouting department and things like that. So there's some tangential connection there, but then also the Braves have just like churned anyone who can play third base in a corner outfield. So nice to see Gavin back in the majors, 1-0-3, but hopefully he can, you know, stick in a role there, give the Braves a little something. I'm so torn though. I respect what the Braves have done. I have all the respect in the world for Alex Anthopoulos. Kind of want the Mets to take this playoff spot though. By the way, elsewhere, AAA. So I mentioned Bobichet didn't play yesterday because he had done five innings in the field on Tuesday. He'll be back in there. Today is the expectation. Arelvis continues to play as he comes back here. He went 0-for-6 with a pair of strikeouts yesterday. And again, we're not going to see him at the major league level, according to the reporting around the team. But they will seek winter at-bats for him in some form. He is not on, I think I have the eight guys that are going to Arizona Fall League. I'll save that until I have it 100% confirmed. But he is not on that list. We'll talk about some of those guys a little later in the show, by the way, because Jeff Ponce of Baseball America is going to join us. Jordan Schusterman and David Roth will also join us as we kind of go around baseball, talk a little bit more about the Mets team. Just take a look at the playoff races in general. The other two notes from the farm. Adam Macko returned to Double-A yesterday. He had been out with a kind of mystery shoulder thing for a couple of weeks there, made a couple of rehab starts. Didn't go super well at Double-A last night, allowed six earned over four innings, but struck out four, settled down after a rough first inning. That'll be his last start of the season because the Fisher Cats end their season on Sunday. We'll see if he gets a bump to Triple-A for one more start or they just send him into his offseason program from there. And then in Vancouver, the Vancouver Canadiens tied up the Northwest League Championship Series at a game apiece. They won 4-3. Yaron Watts Brown with a really good outing. Adrian Pinto, if you remember him from the Randall Grichuk, Ramel Tapia trade, he's missed most of the season injured. Since coming back, he's been red hot at the plate. He had three hits in that one. So game 3, 4, and 5 go on the road Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We will know when we do the show Monday if the Vancouver Canadiens are once again champions or for the second time in 3 years, championship runners up in the Northwest League. So a lot of fun there. Check out your MILB TV over the weekend and keep an eye on those Vancouver Canadiens. The other note at the AAA level, by the way, Jonathan Classe has three stolen bases over his last two games. One caught stealing in there, but nice to see him getting on base a little bit more now so that he can show that speed tool, that base running tool. It had not gone super well for him to start his Buffalo Bisons tenure. Obviously, he has a pretty decent track record at the AAA level and throughout the minors. You know what he can potentially be, but always better to see it than not. The other one, Easton Lucas, who the Jays had picked up on waivers and optioned to AAA, one of those infinite number of relievers on the 40-man, got the start yesterday and threw four no-hit innings. Don't think the intention was for him to go four innings. He's more of a multi-inning relief type the way that the Bisons have deployed him. But when you're not allowing any hits and you're pitch efficient, why not go four innings? So maybe another guy who's on the radar next week to, you know, hey, Luis Frias, we got to look at him. Let's send him down. Let's call someone else up. So Easton Lucas, a name to pocket as well. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk to Jordan Schusterman of Suspettus Family Barbecue and Yahoo Sports. We'll have to also talk to Jeff Ponce. We'll check in around the Jays farm system as some of these teams start to wrap up their seasons. We'll talk to him around 11. We'll talk to David Roth around 11:30 as well. No game tonight to get you ready for. So we'll just kick it around. We'll go around the Blue Jays. We'll go around Major League Baseball as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, little Avril Lavigne playing us back in for our next guest of Yahoo Sports of the Barbie cast of Suspettus Family Barbecue. It's Jordan Schusterman. Jordan, good morning, man. How are you? Wow. Look at that.
Just for you, Blake.
The Avril Lavigne
concert. You were
ready,
I was ready.
Yeah. How was the show? Last time we talked to you, you were about to come to Toronto for the Avril Lavigne concert. How was it? It was outstanding. It was, you know, I did end up doing the double feature. I saw the Blue Jays that Sunday. Avril was that Monday. That was the game where Chris Bassitt gave up like 100 runs in the first inning and then talked about how he didn't know the roof was going to be closed. So that was an interesting 48 hours, but the concert was tremendous. I had a great time. Toronto, beautiful in the summer. I had a wonderful trip.
Yeah, 6-run first inning. I don't know. Everyone else pitched with the dome closed. But there is like an actual impact when the dome's open versus dome closed, like similar to like how pitches don't break left to right at Coors Field. You know, like your changeup doesn't move the same way. Your sinker doesn't get the arm side run the same way. I don't know why the Colorado Rockies don't, you know, invest in people who could take advantage of this stuff. But yeah, it's a real factor. Glad the Avril concert was very, very good. This is not something that our listeners are going to care about a ton, but I am very curious. So your counterpart, Jake, got married on the weekend. You guys obviously go back. I saw that you were at the wedding. How was it? Also, how was, like, I saw you were still banging out content over the course of a week with a wedding. How was all that?
It was fantastic. Yes. And I believe Jake is finally coming back on the grid today. He'll be back on our pod tomorrow. But no, it was incredible. I mean, I got married, you know, a year ago, and it was really cool to just have, obviously, Jake and I, having been worked together for, you know, 10 years now, a lot of the people and grown up together. Right. I mean, we met when we were 12. So, you know, Jake and I have a lot of parts of our lives that have kind of overlapped. And so getting to celebrate him and his wife Tamar, now someone who I've known Tamar longer than Jake's known Tamar. So it's really cool to just be there with a lot of baseball people and just friends and family. It was really, really special. And I hope he enjoyed it. I haven't done like a full recap with him. Maybe we'll do that on tomorrow's episode, but it was really fun. So really happy for him.
Safe bet he enjoyed it. I would hope so. It's your wedding. You guys both looked great. He even, of course, point out you didn't wear a ball cap for that one. So that's okay. I have a ball cap related question, and this is going to pivot us back to actual baseball here. So this is a Toronto Blue Jays show. It's aired nationally in Canada. Sometimes I wear a hat on the show, and sometimes I forget that it's a Blue Jays show. Also, sometimes I forget that hats are like team specific, right? Like I wear a Dodgers hat around the city sometimes. It's just a blue hat to me. It's not like, oh, I'm a Dodgers fan today. There was a time where I wore a Dodgers hat on this show last year, I think, and people lost their damn minds. With the Blue Jays being as bad as they are right now, and with the Chicago White Sox headed toward history, I have one of those Southside City Connect Chicago hats, my favorite hat that I have. Do you think I'm in the clear to wear that, since no one's all that invested in the Jays outcomes right now, and the Chicago part of it is obviously like, yeah, I'm supporting the losingest season of all time?
Yeah, 100%. I think there's honestly maybe no better time to wear a White Sox hat. And I have to imagine there's some leeway. The Dodgers example is interesting because they are, you know, not quite Yankees level, but reviled in the same way as just the casual baseball fans is going to be sick of the Dodgers, even if they are in no way a rival of the Blue Jays. I mean, Ohtani stuff aside.
Like, this was pre-Ohtani, too.
Yeah. So it's like, it's pretty random. And I think anything outside of the division is usually in the clear. But this is something I think about too. I try and pick hats that are either topical or at least topical to me. My collection grows basically almost every week. And so I just got three new ones this week. And so I like to mix it up, and it's nice to just be able to pull one out no matter what. I mean, this is, you know, a KBO team, the KT Wiz, that I just, you know, was digging in on this morning, so I felt like wearing it. But nice. I think you're good. I think you should only wear White Sox hats until they break the record.
Yeah, I mean, they're only, what, 6 games away? Yeah, they're at 114 losses. They need 7 losses over their last 15 games. I'm going to say they do it. They have, I think they only won 10 games in between the two presidential debates, which were like 60 plus games apart. They're pretty ridiculous. You mentioned KBO there. I do want to talk mostly Major League Baseball, but while that's come up, we're getting close to KBO playoff time. You know, Japanese baseball will pick up as well. And the lead-on draft yesterday for young players, like the Dominican Winter League's picking up. I know you guys love that. Like, this is peak time for Major League Baseball, too. Like, I was watching two games simultaneously in extra innings last night with AL East implications. But there's still, hey, there's Dominican ball, there's Korean ball. Obviously, the timing lines up a little better to be able to do both. What are you doing these next couple months? Like, how much Dominican ball or KBO playoff ball do you actually get to consume in addition to your MLB role?
Yeah, so KBO and the Japanese League is a little harder just time zone wise. Yeah. But I mean, the Winter League, like, that starts during October. And we've posted pictures about, like, we'll be sitting in press boxes in the postseason watching Winter League just because we can't get enough. And honestly, a lot of it for me, and the rookie draft is a little bit different because a lot of the players that are being drafted right now are not necessarily players we're definitely going to see during this upcoming Winter League season. But that's the baseball that's going to sustain me through the offseason. You know, like I like to say, I mean, there are very, very few actual times during the year where there isn't some sort of baseball happening. And that's because of the Winter League, right? And Dominican one in particular is something I've become very fond of and gotten really kind of entrenched in that world. So I'm looking forward to it. Of course, that does start in the middle of October. So it's like the lowest stakes games going on for them, during the highest stakes games for MLB. But obviously, I try to keep track of all of it as best I can.
Yeah, and there's an interesting, you know, Major League Baseball tie-in here where some Major League Baseball prospects are eligible. Like Junior Caminero, who is now up in the majors and prior to getting promoted was one of the top prospects in baseball, was the number one pick in the Lidom rookie draft last year and ended up playing 20 games down there. So, you know, you obviously take some risk if you're the team. You know, I don't know, you draft the Blue Jay. Maybe the Blue Jay don't want that particular guy in that particular league. But if you get 12, 15 games out of him, sure, it helps move some tickets, win some games. It's a lot of fun. I didn't look too deeply on who actually got drafted yesterday. Blue Jays hit my radar, but I'm sure there are some given how many guys will pop up. Okay, on the Major League Baseball side, only going to trouble you with one Blue Jays question since you're not here this weekend and they are not as interesting
sure.
as
oh,
some
that's
of the.
Fine. I'm here for all the Jays talk. This is whatever you want.
No, this is the only real big question for the Blue Jays right now for anyone outside of Toronto, I think, that I'm curious in is, are you buying on Bowden Francis? Like, this is we are obviously living this start to start, six tremendous starts in a row, really good numbers on the season. Now he's pushing close to 100 innings. I am so curious what people outside of the Toronto bubble are making of Bowden Francis's stretch here.
100%. I think he has pitched himself into a truly fascinating position entering next season. That stat right there, I feel like I need to go put in my thread for somewhat arbitrary statistics that make players look like the greatest, you know, player or pitcher of all time. I mean, this is a truly tremendous run. And I think that, you know, I tweeted a little bit about it yesterday. What is so remarkable is he's not, you know, blowing people away. It's the opposite. It's avoiding the free passes, but it's, and sure, there's certainly some BABIP luck in there because he is not exactly, you know, striking out the world, but he has just found a really good balance of keeping guys off balance. I mean, he is the definition of that, right? And if you can command, he is a good example of, you know, you don't want to go too far down the path of like, oh, see, this is what we miss now. We don't have pitchers anymore. They're just all throwers. But ultimately, you know, when you do see guys like Bowden Francis, you know, succeed, there's some truth to that. And it's not like they can't all be Bowden Francis. And there's a reason that most guys aren't averaging 91 miles an hour on their fastball anymore. But it's really cool. It's a really cool story. And he, the kind of pitcher that he's always been, right? This is someone that has always had success generally without big strikeout totals. And so in that sense, it's not that surprising. But to see him find the kind of success that he was having when he was, you know, dominating in junior college, but now doing it at the major league level is extremely cool. And obviously, personality wise, it seems like we've gotten to know him a little bit better. And he certainly seems like an easy guy to root for.
Yeah, he definitely is. And it continues a long list of Chipola College to Toronto Blue Jays unlikely success stories. Jose Bautista as well. I believe Russell Martin went there. Now, he was less of an unlikely success story. That was sure. It's Russell Martin. He's we knew he was going to be good pretty quickly, and he had a terrific Adam Loan, who was a Canadian and briefly
of course.
I can't remember if he pitched or was an outfielder for the Blue Jays, but because he switched part way, but I can't remember. I think he pitched for the Blue Jays anyway. And Bowden Francis, you know, like to your point about command, he throws five pitches for them. He throws for strikes, and he doesn't really walk anyone. He trusts the deceptive fastball in the zone. That's even if you're going to give up the Francisco Lindor home run, the Taylor Ward home run, solo home runs don't hurt you that badly, right? Like, that's it's a good formula to create a sustainable floor as a pitcher, even if you're not going to be a 250 strikeout guy.
100%. But the last thing which I was kind of working towards, which is so why he is so fascinating, is of course the run he's on itself is worth celebrating and analyzing and talking about. So that's it. But as we obviously, a lot of what this Blue Jays last, you know, few games is already thinking about next year. And you think about this Blue Jays rotation and how much they've invested in it and how much a lot of it has had kind of disappointed early in the season. You know, Manoa remains the ultimate wild card for a lot of reasons. And of course the injury, you know, it has impacted that. But the fact that Bowden Francis is now, as things stand, can kind of go into next year in theory with a rotation spot in a pretty good position. When you think about how that impacts someone they've invested in, like Yariel Rodriguez, when you think about some of these other veteran pitchers who they're paying a lot, I mean, it opens up a lot of questions. I mean, there's a lot of questions about this Blue Jays offseason, but you have to wonder, Ricky Tiedemann, another guy, right? Where does he fit into this mix? Some of these other guys that they maybe have coming up. I think it's interesting. Do they choose to move on from a Chris Bassett, you know, or I mean, Berríos is in a longer term, but even a Gausman, like it seems a little extreme, but, and I'm not saying they should do that, but now it gives them both more flexibility, but some more choices to kind of make about that rotation going into 25.
Yeah, and I think flexibility is the key word there because, you know, I don't, if they're going to compete in 2025, I don't think they trade one of those guys away, but maybe this is a case where the guy who loses, you know, Yariel Rodriguez loses out on a starting spot, say, and he is one of your solutions to the league's worst bullpen. Because he's back there like he was in Japan as a multi-inning guy.
Yeah.
Bowden Francis, by the way, another guy who benefited from winter league ball. He went down to Puerto Rico two winters ago and really figured out the curveball and how to throw it for strikes. So, I've always value there. Okay, so the Jays lost yesterday. Despite Bowden Francis's best efforts, Lindor hits the big home run, and then they pile on a bunch of runs on the Blue Jays bullpen. This has been something the Mets have done pretty regularly. Francisco Lindor, you know, Jose Iglesias was a part of it. Obviously, he's had a fun season. Mark Vientos is like Mr. Clutch this year. He got in on the action there. And the Mets are now back slightly ahead of the Atlanta Braves in that third wildcard spot, slightly ahead of the Atlanta Braves in the Fangraphs playoff odds. The Padres and D-backs in the mix there, but they're both up around like 93% playoff odds at this point. What are you making of this Mets-Braves race here?
It is very fun. And, you know, at Yahoo this week, I wrote about the AL race, which is a little bit less compelling. And you have, you know, these three teams, Detroit, Boston, and Seattle, that are just like hanging on for dear life here while Minnesota tries to fend them off. But I mean, this is as good as it gets. And it's interesting, though, right? Because, you know, last year, when you think about the National League wild card race, it was these teams scrapping for, you know, 83, 84 wins that we, you know, the Marlins, right, and the D-backs. And, of course, the D-backs have kind of ascended to a different level. But lower profile, small market teams where it's like they're good, they're solid, they're having a good year. Maybe they sneak it, right? Like the Reds were in the mix to the final
Miami
weekend last
somehow.
Year as well. Yeah, Miami. Miami was, they made it. They made it, right? So those were the teams we were talking about for that last spot last year, whereas this year, to have these two kind of behemoths of the sport in very different positions, because the Braves were a huge favorite coming into the year and their season has been ravaged by injuries to many of the best players in the sport. That's continued now, possibly with Ronaldo Lopez. And then you have the Mets, who have somehow adopted this like lovable underdog mentality, despite still having, you know, some of the best players, especially on offense, in the league, a possible MVP candidate, a $300 million payroll. But it's genuine. Like, I do find them very likable. I have, and they are undermanned in some respects, but it is an interesting contrast to the kinds of discussions we were talking about it. But at the very least, and from a neutral standpoint, and from someone who talks about this all the time, from someone who engages and talks with fans across the league, having Mets and Braves fans involved in this last run is very compelling, not to mention the fact that the Mets still have 10 games remaining against both the Phillies and they do play the Braves in that final week. So this will be very, very fun. I'm curious how the fans will take this, right? Because the Braves and some fans in some senses are like, this season is all like, whatever. If we survive, we survive. All of our best players are out. So be it. But also it's like, oh, if we get in with this pitching, anything's possible. Whereas the Mets are just, you know, having a great time. I am curious what the Met fan response will be if/when they come up short, right? Is it going to be like, oh, that was fun? Or is it going to get back to like, hello, like, we need to start winning. Like, and now Pete Alonso might leave. Like, I'm really, really curious about Mets fans' mindsets at this stage. They're having a great time right now, as they should. But there's a lot. This roster is going to change a lot next year. There are a lot of guys in this team that are not under contract next year. And so, you know, they're entering a fascinating winter regardless of how these next few weeks go. But I think that will dramatically impact it as well.
Yeah, and I wonder if Mets fans who let go of all expectations in like late May and have been having fun with this since, when it comes down to the final week of the season and you're in Atlanta and the playoff spot is on the line and you have that like that shared history in Atlanta late in seasons, if it's not going to feel very good for that, they've been dragged back in, right, to caring. Yeah. Now and believing.
Yeah.
So it could be even more painful in the end. It'd be one thing if they just like came up short, but like if you're gonna come up short, it's going to be at the hands directly of the Atlanta Braves. So it's that could be ugly. You did write about the AL races this week. What, I mean, I read the piece, but for my audience who if they didn't check it out at Yahoo Sports and they could check it out after, what do you think the chances are that a Detroit, a Seattle, a Boston can kind of upset what the status quo has been? Because it's held the same teams for a long time now, but yeah, there are a couple teams that don't seem, I'm not overwhelmed by the yeah, back of this wild card race. And as a Jays person, it is extra frustrating to see, but could one of these kind of fringe teams make the push?
Yeah, I do feel like one of them is going to hang around until that final week. I mean, they all have slightly different possible paths to get there. And Boston's just been so tough to figure out. And they're only, all of their games remaining are against either divisional opponents or the Twins. And so both of those teams, both Boston and Seattle, have opportunities because the Mariners are unique in that they still technically have a potential shot at a division. And they do still have the Astros on their schedule. So in that sense, it's they need to survive until they go to Houston, whereas Boston needs to survive until Minnesota goes to Fenway Park, which is, I believe, at the end of next week or maybe the beginning of the week after that. So there are opportunities on the schedule there, whereas Detroit is in an interesting spot where they don't play any of the teams ahead of them. They got six against Baltimore, which is tough, but they do, you know, they have this Rockies finale today, and they're rightly beating up on them, and then they got the White Sox to finish the season. And so if they can hang on until the very, very end there, and Detroit is a really tough team to talk about for me, because as I was writing and I was like, oh, there's by far the least pressure on them. We weren't expecting anything from them. And if they make it to the end, the fans are still going to be feeling pretty good, you know, going into next season. At the same time, as I pointed out, that's the team with the longest postseason drought in baseball, along with the Angels. And so it's like, at the same time, you know, is it really realistic to be like Tigers fans, like, ah, it's fine, you know, just wait till next year? Like, you do kind of have a shot here, and they're playing somewhat well enough to maybe sneak in. I don't see them as a World Series team because their rotation is Tarek Skubal, and I mean, they're really just like bullpenning almost every other game. I know Cater Montero had a complete game the other day, but he hasn't exactly been awesome until then. So all these teams are interesting in their own way, but the stakes is really what I wanted to get into, because I think how this is going to be responded to by, I mean, Seattle fans are already so mad. Boston fans are already so mad. They're going to enjoy it until the end, but it's not looking great, obviously, for those three teams. I think Minnesota is still in a good position.
Yeah, and the Tigers, I mean, yeah, anytime you don't control, like, you're not playing the teams ahead of you, it's just so much tougher. And yeah, their bullpen's been unbelievable, but is that going to be enough to get you there? You mentioned the Angels playoff drought there, by the way. The Angels, this is what we'll end on here. How thankful do you think Perry Manassian and the Angels are that the White Sox have existed this year? Because the Angels are like, I feel like they're skating by with like one of the worst seasons in franchise history amid one of the worst like 10 to 15 year stretches of any franchise in modern. And everyone's just like, yeah, the White Sox. And even to some extent, the Rockies, the Angels just kind of skating by here.
I could not agree more. Not that they haven't, you know, been criticized for having literally zero winning seasons with Shohei Ohtani and Mike Trout. But yeah, I mean, there's a chance they will have their worst season in franchise history. And, you know, they extended Perry, and I'm all for stability and not trying to shake things up over and over and trust that you're sort of building something. And they've had some steps forward at the major league level, but we're still talking about what has been one of the worst farm systems in baseball for like 5 or 6 years in a row. Like that's pretty hard to do. I know they are promoting players very quickly and that's contributing to that to some degree, but that is what is really ominous and bleak about the Angels' near and long-term future is it's just hard to see the path. It's hard to know what it looks like for the best case scenario for this group coming together. And it just bumps me out because I love Mike Trout and I want him to be happy. But I definitely agree with you. I think them among all the other bad teams that are probably appreciating the White Sox existence this year, that is definitely one that stands out.
Yeah, it's tough when, you know, the strategy of, well, just go get the two best players that any of us might ever watch. They did that and it didn't work. They couldn't even finish above 500. They haven't won a playoff game in like 15 years. Ridiculous. Yeah. Jordan, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Shouts out to Avril. And we'll do this again soon, man.
Absolutely. Jordan Schusterman of Yahoo Sports, of Suspetta's Family Barbecue and the Barbiecast over at Yahoo Sports. A lot of great stuff there. Could have kept him for another hour. But we got other guests to get to. Let's take a break. Let's go down on the farm. Jeff Ponce, our guy at Baseball America, he is the Blue Jays person at Baseball America, in addition to the Red Sox, who, by the way, have four players in the top 25 prospects now, which is terrifying, in addition to everything else going on in the American League East and comparing the Jays to every other team there, current and future roster-wise. It's not great. Anyway, let's talk to Jeff Ponce about the Blue Jays prospects. Let's get a sense of who might be heading down to Arizona Fall League a little later as well. And, yeah, we'll just talk some general prospect stuff. David Roth will join us in the second hour as well as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. We're going to talk some prospects this segment. On the prospect front, just a note that David Singh has a great piece up at sportsnet.ca. He spoke to Francisco Lindor about Blue Jays first round pick from last year, Arjun Namala, who obviously we talked about a lot on the show yesterday, did a Blue Jays Central hit on him on Tuesday. He just wrapped up a pretty terrific first season for a guy who is way younger than everyone at his level. Again, the stat I dropped yesterday on Blue Jays Central, he had one plate appearance all year against a pitcher who was younger than him, and he still finished with the second best OPS in the Florida State League. David Singh, great piece on the relationship between Arjun Namala and Francisco Lindor, who is a big believer in Namala and works out with him in the offseason. So make sure you go check that out. And now let's talk some prospect stuff with our favorite prospect guy, Jeff Ponce of Baseball America. Jeff, good morning. How we doing, man?
Pretty good, man. How you doing?
Good. Before we talk Jay-specific stuff, how is this time of year for you? Like, as leagues are wrapping up and stuff, is this like more chill because there are fewer games? Is this like high work time to like start doing your early, you know, off-season guide work? What are these couple weeks for you where there are fewer games, but I'd imagine it's like a big mental organization time?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is just sort of wrapping up, the work that we've done throughout the season, kind of, you know, checking everything over, making sure that we're getting final looks if we can, trying to get as much video as I can the last couple of weeks, just so we have some video to promote a lot of the content we'll be putting out this off season. There's no more ranking updates this season. None of that stuff. We'll kind of push that forward into the fall and early winter, where the top 10s will come out for the NL first, I think sometime in October. Sometime in November, we'll start to see the AL top 10s, and then top 30s will obviously roll out once that handbook is in the week before Christmas. That's when we send the handbook in. If you haven't familiar with that, we do top 30 reports for all 30 teams. There's a bunch of other information in that book as well. It's something that we've put out now, I believe, for 24 years. I think this might actually be the 25th anniversary of the handbook. So that's pretty cool. And of course, I'll be covering Jay's prospects in the off season as well.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. It's an indispensable resource every off season. And then obviously there are the digital components behind the subscription wall as well, if you want to read the digital write-ups. I'm a physical copy guy. Like, I got my Baseball America, my baseball prospectus every year. It's necessary for me for whatever reason. I got to highlight stuff that I'll never open the page on again. I just got to do it. So sure. I'm looking forward to that. Arizona Fall League's around the corner. How useful is that for you guys in what you do? Like I know some teams approach it of, well, we want our best prospects to get more experience. Some teams are like, well, this guy didn't get enough plate appearances this year, was coming back from injury and doesn't have a lot of innings. Like, there's such a mix of type of guys that get sent to Arizona Fall League. Do you get much, like, do AFL performances move the needle for you much?
Yeah, I don't think the performance itself necessarily moves the needle. I mean, we can look back in the last couple of years and who some of the top names were in terms of slash line and production and all that sort of stuff versus who the actual top prospects were. I think it's more about, like, I'm going to be out there the first week of the season. My teammate Josh Norris will be out there the following week or two. So we'll have coverage for about half of the league. I think the early weeks of the league, too, are really when the talent is at its best before guys go home, some injuries, things dissipate, guys get shut down, all that sort of stuff. But I do think it is an opportunity to, in a very tight window within a, you know, small a square mile radius, be able to see a ton of the top prospects in the game, guys who are going to be up in the big leagues, not just in 2025, but likely in 2026, because you tend to skew a little bit older within that league, a little bit more experienced players. But, you know, I think it's just such a mixed bag in terms of what you see on the pitching side. As we know, it's a very short sample size. Even a month or 5-6 week long season is really a pretty small sample in the big picture of things. So I think for me, it's more about getting out there, seeing what guys are doing, things that guys are working on, maybe new pitches. If it's somebody, like you said, who might have dealt with, you know, bad luck in terms of health in the past season, it gives us an opportunity to maybe get a little bit more of an extended look. But I think what I'm looking at is really just more skills, swing path, quality, you know, the types of takes this guy's taking, what he can hit, what he can't hit, stuff that he's maybe scared to swing on, what the player looks like defensively. And sometimes in the AFL, you will see players play a variety of different positions, sometimes outside of their norm, sometimes positions that could be, part of their profile going forward. So I think it's a really interesting league. It's a lot of fun. And I think whenever you can condense a lot of good talent within to a handful of teams, it's going to be worthwhile baseball to watch.
Yeah, it's always struck me as, I mean, I bounce right back to basketball when baseball's done, so I don't know if, like, schedule-wise I'll ever get to go, but it strikes me as something that would be super fun as obviously for your purposes, but even just as a baseball fan to go down for a couple of days, you know, similar to people who make the spring training trek and stuff like that.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about a couple of Blue Jays prospects. So you see this New Hampshire Fisher Cats team a bunch. I know you saw them last week in addition to, you know, being the primary Jays guy for the handbook in general. I wanted to ask you about a few names, and one that you had mentioned to me before we came on and was already in my notes is RJ Schreck. He was the return for Justin Turner from the Mariners, was not, you know, in the Mariners top 30 at the time, wasn't in the Jays top 30 in the update, but he has torn the cover off the ball since joining that New Hampshire team. Only a 27 game sample, but a 905 OPS, which was a little surprising to me. What have you seen from RJ Schreck since he joined the Jays organization?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, he's probably been among the most impressive hitters that I've seen in New Hampshire this season, just in terms of, you know, what he can do from a contact and approach standpoint. There's not huge underlying power. He's not a guy that's going to, you know, put up eye-popping sort of EVs, but there's enough power there with really good bat path, the ability to optimize contact to his pull side so he can get into that power and backspin the ball, you know, to his pull side. He plays with a little bit of fire. This is a guy that, you know, was kind of cast aside coming out of Vanderbilt as a guy who wasn't really going to be much of a prospect. And, you know, I think he's proven this season that that's very much inaccurate. And I would say is probably the best hitter on that New Hampshire team at the moment.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it hasn't been the best New Hampshire team, but it's sure. Fun to see that. It's fun to see those stats and some of the missiles that make the video rounds. That this is a New Hampshire team that is more interesting on the pitching side. I did want to ask you about one more double A guy who I hadn't mentioned ahead of time, so apologies for that. But Charles McAdoo, sure. who's you know sure. came on the show after he got traded over. Obviously, he was a fast rising guy in the Pirates system before that trade. I know the overall numbers weren't tremendous for him at New Hampshire. He was a little under league average bat. But what did you see from McAdoo when you got eyes on him?
Yeah, I think, you know, throughout the season, because I do sort of oversee, I don't write it, but I oversee the Pittsburgh list. One of our writers here, Mark Chiarelli, handles that list. And we were up on McAdoo really early. Saw him a little bit in spring training. I thought he was pretty impressive. He's a physical guy, kind of looks like a running back. Like, you know, he's just a big, strong, burly guy, strong legs, strong arms, broad shoulders. There's power in there. He shows that in game already, but there's some plate skills to go along with it. You know, he's aggressive. He'll go out there and he will swing and miss a little bit, but I think he's aggressive on stuff in the zone. It's not like he has a super high chase rate. It's about 27%, which is about average in terms of what you see, but doesn't miss in the zone much, if at all, but 18.8% zone miss. And then you look at like some of the underlying quality of contact metrics, like ex-Wobicon and stuff like that. And it's been really good. He's got a 106.2 90th percentile. He's hit a ball 112 this year. He elevates contact. I think the biggest question mark with McAdoo is, can this guy stick at third base, or is he left field, maybe first base? I think that's the biggest question mark. He's almost like an upgraded version of like Paul Maggiani, you know, that we saw last year have a really good year in double A, kind of slid back a little bit this year. But, you know, when you look at the bat speed, it's 95th percentile bat speed that he has. The underlying metrics all back it. He's had a really strong year just in terms of the slash line and performance. And I think, you know, overall, you see a guy like this that maybe there's some question marks around where he ends up defensively ultimately. I think the bat might be enough to keep him in the lineup. And they have kind of a couple of these guys in McAdoo and Schreck that are a lot like the guys that have had success in this organization that have that combination of enough contact and approach and good power. I think we saw it with David Schneider. We saw it with Spencer Horwitz this year. Just really balanced hitters that have a good blend of contact, approach, and power. And I think that's what McAdoo fits right into.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see a little bit more of the power translate up to the higher levels. You know, this tends to be, I mean, we're seeing it more from Spencer Horwitz at the major league level this year than maybe we anticipated when he got called up. But yeah, a lot of the more interesting Jays hitting prospects, like, yeah, it does a lot of stuff well. You know, maybe the power will come. So it's nice to have a guy like McAdoo who's showing it in game already. So I mentioned this New Hampshire team was a little more interesting on the pitching side. Now, a couple of those interesting pitchers are old for the double A level, were old for the high A level when they started the season. But let's talk about a couple of them. And I think a couple of these names, no one has 100% confirmed the Arizona Fall League list for me, but I'm pretty sure Ryan Jennings and Lazaro Estrada are both going. So let's check in on those guys. Ryan Jennings, again, an overage guy, but absolutely dominant at high A. And then you got to look at him moved to the bullpen when he went up to New Hampshire, I think more because of an innings total concern. But what did you see from Ryan Jennings, who just has, you know, eye-popping ERA stuff, even if he is a little old for high A and double A?
Yeah, and had some injuries and things that he's dealt with over his first couple of years. But, you know, I think you look at a guy like Jennings and, yeah, he can start in the lower levels, probably in the upper levels for a little bit. But I think clearly he's a reliever and a guy who can handle leverage innings. It's, sort of interesting release traits, gets really good playing in the fastball, sits, you know, 95 to 96 miles an hour as a reliever. He's a guy that can run it up to 98, 99. And, you know, frankly, if he's fully healthy and kind of committed to the relief role, it wouldn't shock me if he's popping 100s within a couple of years. Heavy arm side run in that fastball. It's kind of an interesting shape. Not great ride, but with that power, the fact that he can command it somewhat and has that heavy arm side run, I think is really valuable. It's a really tight gyro slider at like 85, 86 miles per hour, maybe a pitch that in relief, once again, he could even be throwing at 86 to 88 miles an hour. He kind of has sat there at points in time early in starts this season. He'll mix in a curveball, he'll mix in a changeup. So he has a varied arsenal, but it's fastball quality and then two quality breaking ball shapes that You know, I think in portend success out of the pen, probably not a reliever, just, I mean, starter, just based on his track record of not really having a ton of innings, going deep into starts. He kind of doesn't have that horsepower that's needed, but certainly has the horsepower to sort of come out of the bullpen and light up the radar gun, generate tons of swings and misses and close out games, or, you know, pitch seventh, eighth innings in high leverage spots. I think that's what you sort of see from Jennings.
When you see a guy like that, I know he's only had a couple innings at Double A this year, but he is already 25. If he gets those extra Arizona Fall League reps, you like the relief profile like that. Is that a guy who by the end of 2025 could be on the Major League bullpen radar, or is that a little too quick?
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. I think this is definitely a guy who could be on the Major League bullpen, you know, in May of next year. He's kind of done his thing at the Double A level. As long as he handles himself early in Triple A, I think it's certainly possible that, you know, Jennings could be up, you know, like I said, May, maybe June, if things go really, really well, if there's a need in the bullpen. I think that's kind of how he's viewed. And, you know, I think the one thing that maybe is working against them is the Blue Jays do have a handful of good relief prospects in the upper minors who are on the 40-man or need to be added to the 40-man roster. Jennings is still a year away from that 40-man decision. I think they'll jump that and put him onto the 40 at some point next year and promote him up in the majors. But that could potentially maybe, you know, push back the ETA on him a little bit, maybe into a June or July. But, like, you know, all things are dependent on health within this bullpen, within the pitching staff, and opportunities could pop up. And, you know, certainly he has the skills and ability. And as you said, he's a little bit older. So I think he's a guy that you can move to the major leagues, and you're not all that worried about losing that extra year of control or service time or any of the 40-man stuff that, you know, he may push you to make decisions on.
Yeah. Okay. So let's pivot to a guy who, I mean, does technically need a 40-man decision because he is Rule 5 eligible. Laz Estrada has been in this system forever, it feels like. Enough that he signed a minor league extension this year because, like, you know, he's been here long enough that he could have been a minor league free agent. Now, he's had some stop and start around the pandemic and some injuries in 2021, 2022. Now, so because of that stop and start, he starts the season at A-ball, and it's his fourth time making an appearance in A-ball. So right away, I'm like, okay, he's almost 25 at that point. It's in A-ball again. Like, this is just an org depth guy. And then he gets the bump to high A, and then he throws a no-hitter, and then the numbers are crazy over the course of his entire A-ball, and then he gets the bump to Double A, and, you know, it's a 4.50 ERA, but some of the underlying stuff is pretty encouraging there. What have you seen from Laz Estrada at the Double A level? Another guy who I think is headed to the Arizona Fall League.
Yeah, and he's actually, I believe, minor league free agent after this season as well. I think the intention from the organization is likely to re-sign him, so it wouldn't shock me if he's back. And then likely probably added to the 40-man roster. Certainly they could add him to the 40-man roster and avoid minor league free agency as well. We'll see where they go with that. I know internally in the organization they feel that he's probably one of the biggest misses on my top 30 list, and he's not on the top 30. I think for the offseason, as long as he does resign as a minor league free agent or is added to the 40-man roster, probably has a good shot of being somewhere in that like 25 to 30 range. You know, it's not the most exciting profile, but he does have some things, you know, going for him just in terms of fastball quality. He doesn't throw that hard. He sits maybe 91 to 93 miles an hour. You'll see a 94. Every so often, you know, he'll reach back and scrape out a 95 or a 96, but he does that with elite shape. It's like 19 to 20 inches of IVB pretty consistently. Gets a heavy amount of arm side run in that pitch as well, 10 to like 12 inches of arm side run. So it's, you know, pretty heavy bore. It's like an excellent shape, not all that different from the shape of like a Garrett Cole sort of fastball. Doesn't have the power, doesn't have the full release traits, but does get a flatter plane of approach. We know that that's, you know, an attribute that leads to a lot of swing and miss. And I think we've seen some of those results against the fastball this year. It's a flatter, and in a good way, flatter sort of approach angle that it's harder for guys to sort of, you know, hitters to sort of get on plane with that pitch. And, you know, a lot of it is, you know, muscle memory with hitting and just kind of knowing where a pitch is going to go. And it sort of carries a little bit more than it should. He's a higher spin four-seam fastball guy with higher spin efficiency, meaning more of his spin contributes to the actual movement of the ball. I mean, one little lesson here, but we sort of propel a fastball as opposed to throw it. You know, think of it as backspin, you know, ball that carries almost like a fly ball that carries out to, you know, the pull side or whatever. Not all that different in terms of how it moves. And he's a guy that gets that spin efficiency, and I think that allows him to get some of these unique traits. The secondaries are sort of fringy. You know, he's got a softer slot cutter slider type of shape. He's got a slurvy curveball in the top, in the upper 70s. He'll throw you a cutter here and there. Doesn't really throw very many changeups. You'll maybe see one or two a game. So it's an interesting arsenal, somewhat limited. You know, I don't know where to go with a guy like this, because I think there are that potentially could make him like a solid depth starter. You know, your 6-7 starter, the guy that's on the bus back and forth from Buffalo to Toronto. I don't know if he can add enough power. If he does, I think he maybe has a shot to, you know, hack it as a number 5 starter or something like that. He is starter depth. I don't know if they'd maybe move him to the bullpen just because of that fastball quality, a couple of different, off speed and secondary shapes. And maybe he can add some power there. I don't know. It's weird because he's a guy where I feel like when I'm writing a report in a player like this, it's very easy to sort of hedge on a trio of roles here of like, he could be an org guy. He could be a back-end starter. Maybe he's an interesting reliever. So there are some traits there that are there to like. He certainly put himself more on the prospect map than he had been. But as you said, a little bit older, and there's some question marks just in terms of, you know, 91 to 92 mile per hour fastballs, regardless of how good the shape is still a little bit questionable.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the fact that it's been stop start in his time coming up to the minor, like there are a lot of reasons to at least take your time selling yourself on Laz Estrada, but it's been a lot of fun. Okay. Last one for you on that AA pitching staff. And we haven't seen him in a while, but, I think TJ Brock is supposed to go to Arizona Fall League. We haven't seen him since July because of injury. He's had a stop start, but that's a guy who throws 96. And I know was even as a guy who is already a reliever in the minor leagues, like early in his career, you had at number 30 on your Jays top 30 update. If TJ Brock can get in there in some Arizona Fall League games, what would you be looking for from a guy like that who's pitched so little this year?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with him is what does the fastball look like? You know, is he sitting more 95 to 96 like he did this year, or is he sitting more like 97 to 100 miles an hour, which I've seen him as an amateur. I've seen him, you know, in 2023 do that as well. It's not a great fastball shape. Sort of a lot of the – he gets heavy IVB, but the release traits aren't great. There's a little bit of cut. I think he added more hop this year, a little bit more ride under the four seam. I don't know if that detracted from some of the power, but he kind of needs to find that combination of power and shape. His four seam fastball is not his primary pitch, though. It's his slider. He'll throw his slider, you know, probably 50% of the time or thereabouts, maybe about 60% of the time. So it is heavily his most used pitch. It sits 88 to 89 miles an hour. I've seen it in the low 90s before, sort of a cut slider. That's his best swing and miss pitch. And, you know, when he's on, he's landing that slider and he's attacking guys with a fastball and really overpowering them. I think he's somebody that another guy that could potentially be in the mix in that bullpen in the next year or two. They have a lot of really interesting arms that have power, but they all just happen to be out of the bullpen because all the starters have been hurt all year long.
All of them. All of them, and they're all going to be hurt into next year, except for maybe Adam Macko, who got back last night. Yeah, it's a tough one. Okay, I want to pivot outside the Jays just for one or two questions here. So I know in addition to doing all the great prospect stuff at the team level, that is very, hey, what is your Major League Baseball utility and role focused? You also collaborate on some stuff like with Dylan White for the fantasy side. And obviously how we look at a prospect, there's some similarity for real baseball and fantasy because you got to do enough to have a role, right? You got to play.
Sure.
But then there are some guys who, and Chandler Simpson is the example that I will use. So for anyone who doesn't know, he is in AA in the Rays system. Over high A and AA this year, he has hit well over 300 and stolen 100 bases. 100 bases in a minor league season, and he doesn't seem to have that much prospect buzz at all. I mean, using him as an example, how careful do we have to be, you know, scouting a stat line like that, thinking of a guy, even like Tyler Black is a more near to the majors example where, you know, hey, multi-position, he steals a lot of bases in the minors, probably a bench guy for this Brewers team. How much do we have to adjust for that when we look at prospects through the fantasy lens?
Yeah, I think it's valuable, especially with guys like this. I think the big question mark when you look at a guy like Simpson is, where does this player fit into a major league roster? He's with Tampa on top of it. I think there's no question that he's going to hit for contact and get on base. It's a 91% contact rate, which is the 99th percentile of contact rates in pro ball. You know, it's a 5.5% zone miss. He doesn't miss, rarely chases, gets on base. Once he does get on base, it's almost a guarantee he's going to take second. So in some ways, it's almost like you got a guy who can hit 50 doubles without actually hitting 50 doubles. The problem for me with Simpson is the lack of a defensive position. I think we can look at a guy like Victor Scott, some of his struggles earlier this year with the Cardinals, another guy that was close to 100 stolen bases last year in the minors. He has way more power than Simpson does. I actually saw them play together on the same team in the Cape pre-draft a couple of years ago. Bigger guy, just hits a little bit harder. And he doesn't have a whole lot of power, but Simpson really has none. I mean, he's in the bottom 10th percentile in sort of EV numbers, rarely elevates the ball. It's a lot of sort of seeing eye singles, bloop singles over the infielders, right in front of the outfielders, but it has the speed to make things happen. The question, though, is, Victor Scott was a standout center fielder. Chandler Simpson, despite his speed, is a pretty below average defender in left field. So that's kind of the big question mark is, yeah, he does all these really interesting things offensively, but typically this type of profile, you're talking about a 60 or better center fielder. Simpson has not been that. He's not been that, in years. He came up with Georgia Tech and, as an amateur, as more of a middle infielder. The arm is pretty bad. So that's kind of moved him to the outfield, but still I think limits his ability in some ways. So he's a really interesting prospect because, as you said, from a fantasy perspective, he's, a guy that could win you a category.
Story Ruiz last year.
Yeah.
Not a good baseball player, but he can run, steal bases.
I think he's a better hitter than Ruiz.
Okay,
honestly.
That's good.
Less power, but a better contact hitter. He kind of has more of an identity. The big question with him is, will Tampa play him in left field? Knowing that he's not a guy that's going to add 20 home run pop. We saw that with Randy Arozarena, who's a below average left fielder. But Arozarena at the same time was, a guy who could hit 280 with 20-20 and, score and do all these things and drive in runs. Simpson's really more of a table setter, more of like a traditional or like a Tony La Russa number nine hitter, where he's like the double leadoff guy or whatever you want to use that term. That's kind of how I see him. I do think he's a big leaguer. I think he's going to have, a decent career, but it might be more Dave Roberts, Jared Dyson than it is like Vince Coleman or even Billy Hamilton or someone like that. So Simpson's interesting. Another one that's a really weird profile, and I just don't know how a team would necessarily handle him. If he ends up with a non-competitive team, I think there's a chance he'd get 162 games and probably has a shot to steal like 70, 80 bases. The 100 stolen base number in the major leagues is just such an absurd number. We haven't seen it in so long. I mean, I was a little kid last time I think somebody stole 100 bases, and I'm pretty old. So, I don't necessarily know where to go with the Simpson profile, but he's a super interesting and exciting player to watch.
Honestly, my hope is now the way you've framed it up, and I own him in one dynasty league, which is why I used him as the example. It's just, I hope the Rays generally don't do a lot of prospect for major league help trades, but maybe there's some, hey, get him on Oakland, get him on Colorado or something like, Colorado, he definitely couldn't survive playing the outfield in Coors, but get him on a team like that. Get him on the Angels, let him cook. Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time out. I was going to ask you about all the Red Sox prospects that are now in the top 25, but shucks, we're running out of time in the segment. Don't have to ask about Roman Anthony and the foursome of top 25 prospects. Ridiculous.
We've written a ton about him. I've written a ton about him over the last couple of weeks, had some interviews with Anthony and Campbell, got some quotes from my Traject article yesterday. So
yeah. You
can go check those out and get some insight into what the Red Sox are doing in terms of hitting development, which I think has been a big win for them. And has allowed them to develop some of these hitters into guys with a really good balance and blend of contact, approach, and power. So it's an interesting group. I watched them last night.
It's annoying. It's annoying. Yeah, as an AL East team, thanks so much for taking the time out, Jeff. And that Traject article was awesome, by the way. Great work on that, as always. Jeff Ponce of Baseball America. Make sure you're checking out all the great stuff. And yeah, in addition to the top 30s and the scouting reports and things like that, Jeff doing some cool reporting with a lot of insight from players on Traject. You've heard us talk about Traject before. It's that machine that, you know, the Jays have used it. Matt Hagg's used it with some of the Buffalo guys a little bit that will, you know, better mimic spin than a standard pitching machine or someone throwing BP or whatever. The Traject is the one where, like, you know, it's set up to also try to, you know, you can't pick it up early. It's, you know, if you see one of those screens with like the image of a pitcher on and a little hole in it, and then it comes out of there and it's breaky, it's cool. Anyway, go read the piece. He does a better job in like 1500 words describing it than I can in 30 seconds. Let's take a break. When we go back on the other side, we'll talk to David Roth about the Mets and we'll remember some guys. We're going to remember some Jays. We're going to remember some Mets. We're going to go all over the place. Kansas City Royals 2024, by the way, are the most remembersome guys team of all time. It appears to be their entire roster building strategy around Bobby Witt. We'll talk about that all next with David Roth as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, a little brain stew, a little Godzilla soundtrack for our next guest, David Roth of Defector. He joins us now. What's up, buddy? How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you? I'm honored that you would dip into the Godzilla soundtrack for this.
I mean, look, you are a former guest of the POD cast with our pal John Cullen. It's a terrific album. There's an untitled Silverchair song on there that was very near and dear to me as an elementary school kid. Terrific album.
Yeah, that was the big revelation for me in listening through to that record was that Silverchair song actually kind of rocks. And then also that there's a version of a Green Day song that is like the laziest tie-in to a movie that I've ever seen. It's the song. It's like Everlong or something like that. But they just added Godzilla sounds to the chorus, which to me is exactly how you're supposed to approach putting a song on a movie soundtrack.
Yeah, especially a big one like that where they're going to make a big deal out of soundtrack. You just mail that in. We don't need to do like the one Twilight movie that has like the best emo / pop punk soundtrack of all time. We could just like the Godzilla movie is like a grunge / early new metal movie. That's what we need to do with it. Okay, before everyone stops listening, let's pivot to baseball. Let's pivot to baseball just for a little bit here. We're not going to do it too seriously. The Mets. They just took 2 out of 3 against the Blue Jays. They're back ahead of the Braves in the wild card race. You are obviously a Mets fan. How are you feeling?
Is it that obvious just because I look like I sleep poorly and have an unhealthy diet? Yeah, I'm feeling all right. They didn't play great against Toronto. You know, whatever, you saw it. But part of getting to the postseason is just a matter of like winning games that you shouldn't win by rights. And they did that. I think that I feel terrible for Bowden Francis. I guess it's apparently the second time in his last 4 starts that he's lost a no-hitter in the 9th inning, which is a dagger that I can't even imagine. But, I mean, the game that the Mets won because of a bunch of pass balls is like, you got to win like 3 or 4 of those to sneak into a wild card if you're a flawed team, which the Mets really are. But I would say they've already exceeded my expectations. Like, my hope was that I wouldn't be sick of them by the time September rolled around, and I'm not. So like that's it. At this point, it's house money for me.
That's perfect. I mean, we can aim higher than that, but given where this team was in late May, that's about where you can aim. So I kicked this around with someone a little earlier and on yesterday's show, but maybe you could tell me how you feel about this. Obviously, once a season hits a certain point, especially coming off of last year where like Cohen was like, yeah, we're not going all in for 2025, you know, hey, the guys were trading to Houston. It's not going to be this year. And then the season doesn't start that well. And you're kind of like this is like not house money, but like the expectations were low. This is good. This is like an innocent climb back up. Are you back in enough now that not making it would hurt?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
This is the magic of being a fan, is just like finding new ways to be super duper stupid every year. And for me, this one was like, I think the reasonable expectation for the Mets this year, like the kind of, because they talked about this as a bridge year. They did unwind a bunch of contract obligations last year. The payroll is still incredibly high because it's the Mets, but they got out from under a lot of older players. And so the idea was, this is a year where, you know, you kind of see what you can see. It's a new GM. They're still kind of getting rid of all the, you know, rotten floorboards from the previous ownership regime. And so there was a part of me that, you know, if you told me before the year, like, are they going to be between like 85 and 90 wins? Like, that sounded about right to me. And I didn't think that they would. I thought that would be like a better case scenario, which is basically the way that it was all through the previous ownership, was that they would, you know, build a high variance 84 win team. Maybe things work out and they make the playoffs. Maybe things don't and they win 77 games and the manager gets fired. In this case, they're more or less where I expected them to be, and I still can't be normal about it. And I don't think that that's a me issue. I'm a normal guy. I make good decisions every day. Everybody knows this about me. But the aspect of it, I guess, just the fan part of it. And as you said, like, because the season was so lopsided, it was, you know, they really were one of the worst teams in baseball, basically until June. And then they have been, record-wise, the best team in the National League since then. And that doesn't make no damn sense. Like, it's just, if you watch them play, like, it doesn't exactly fit. But that's what the wild card brings to baseball, is, you know, like, last year the Diamondbacks make the playoffs with 84 wins and then get to the World Series. Like, these things happen. I'm not used to them happening to the Mets, and it's kind of hard for me to get my head around it, but I'm trying to enjoy it and, like, remember what my actual expectations are, because if I'm suddenly, you know, wanting them to win out, like, I'm just guaranteeing that I'm going to be more upset than usual.
Yeah, that series against the Braves the last week of the season will be a difficult one for you. The other thing about the Mets doing this is, like, they haven't just been like, oh, we're good and we have great players and we're going to get on a heater. They've been really fun. Like, there's been the Jose Iglesias, first of all, coming back to earth as a player, and then the Condoleezza song and everything like that. There is obviously the Edwin Diaz return. That's fun. There's the Grimace stuff. You know, even like Mark Vientos becoming the most clutch player in baseball for a couple weeks there.
Yeah.
When you, like, obviously this team is not as good as the Mets team that won over 100 games 2 years ago and got bounced pretty quickly. But in terms of how much fun you're having with the season and how you've gotten here, where does this rank, you know, over the last handful of Mets years for you?
I mean, very, very high. I'd say that, like, the apex for me as an adult was the 2015 team that made it to the World Series and lost to the Royals. And that was not dissimilar to this one. I'm not saying it's similar expectations, but it was the sort of thing where, like, that team started out bad, like, legit bad. Like, the opening day lineup had, like, John Mayberry Jr. in it. Like, it's a lot of stuff that, you know, is easy to forget when the team gets you in a Cespedes. Everything clicks. All the pitching works. This doesn't have that feeling because, as you said, the team's not quite as good. But I was saying to friends around the time that the Jose Iglesias song and, like, the whole, like, OMG movement in the clubhouse was happening, that, like, if something cool was going to happen with this team, like, if they were going to wind up being more fun than I think we had expected, it would be something weird like that. Like, it would be something, you know, coming from a utility infielder and everybody sort of, like, catches the vibe and decides that they're having fun. Even the team that, you know, won 100 odd games, for a while they were really, you know, kind of swaggy. By the time they got to the end of that season, they were juiceless and very much the sort of team that would get bounced out of the playoffs like they did by the Padres. The Mets, I would rather cheer for a team, and maybe this is dumb of me as a fan, but, like, if you accept it as basically a television show that you watch every night, I would rather watch one with, like, good vibes and fun energy than, like, total system mastery. And this is a year in baseball when there's not going to be a 100 win team. There are teams that are better than other teams. There's a, you know, this little elite sort of at the top of each league, but that elite is not that dominant necessarily by historic standards. And so at some point, this is like the best show that you could hope to watch, you know, is people having fun playing baseball, winning in stupid ways. Like, it would be cool if they could win like 110 games and cruise to the World Series, I guess. But, like, I think I wouldn't have as much fun watching it as I've had watching this.
I think the conclusion of that, it would be the best season finale you've ever watched. But yeah, it would be the episodes that get you there. The first 12 episodes wouldn't be quite as entertaining. It would be like you know that nothing is going to happen until the season finale that really matters for you. So you mentioned that 2015 team. Unfortunate that we just didn't crown a World Series champion that season. The Blue Jays, you know, they were just left in the ALCS, and the Mets just played against no one in the World Series. I do want to use that, though, because for those who don't know, David Roth is the king of remembering some guys. It was a Deadspin thing. It's a Defector thing. And there would be no World Series this year that would be more fitting for the remember some guys ethos and philosophy generally than this 2024 Royals team. And I don't really want a Royals Mets rematch to bring back those 2015 memories. But man, when you look at, and I didn't intend to talk too much to you about the Royals, but when you look at that roster, how much does that, like, the way the Royals have built this thing out, especially since injuries struck, how much does that scratch an itch for you as a guy who loves the Tommy Pham, Yuli Gurriel, Robbie Grossman types down the line?
The like sort of commodity tranche of baseball players, the sort of like, their whole system, their whole plan this year seems to have basically been that this is like, they made a lot of signings during the offseason, but nothing where you would, you know, be wowed by like, oh my gosh, they got Michael Wacha. Amazing. Like they basically identified that the division they're in stinks and that the core of young players that they had was pretty good, but was not going to be surrounded, you know, with sufficient speed by other players from their system. And they just went out and like bought affordable players, like Hunter Renfro grade guys. And then, as you pointed out, like once Vinny Pasquantino got injured, they just did the like supermarket sweep run down the guys aisle at the store, just like grabbing Robbie Grossman's like hams and throwing them into the cart. And I love the idea of winning that way. I think that most of, you know, the secret to the team is that Bobby Witt Jr. is amazing and he's gonna have like a 10 win season, I think, by the time it's all said and done. That's crazy. But the rest of it, the idea that you could basically have a decent core and then decide to just augment it with freely available goofballs, like guys that you would get in a pack of baseball cards and be like, huh, like to do that and then to go ahead and like challenge for a division all year long is pretty cool. It also shows how embarrassing it is that more teams don't try to do it. Like if there's one valuable lesson from this, it's that I hope that the Royals can shame the rest of the league into competing a little bit harder, because like if literally the Royals can do it, there's no reason why like the Cubs or Cardinals need to act the way they do.
Yeah, and this is how the Royals kind of built in 2015 as well. And I know they had that killer bullpen where like every game was really like a five inning. You had to beat them in the first couple innings of the game and you had to make sure Ryan Goins didn't drop a ball and stuff. But this idea that the best way to win is to have really great players, and they do have that with Bobby Witt Jr., but the next best way to be good is to not have bad players. And sometimes that means, you know, for the Jays this year, had the Jays ended up not being quite as bad, like the fact that they got a lot out of Isaiah Kiner-Falefa would have looked like a big deal. The fact that the Royals have gotten a lot out of Paul DeJong, who the Jays traded for last year's deadline and had to immediately DFA because they didn't, like those guys do, especially in wildcard races this tight, they do kind of make a difference like that. So outside of the Royals, the idea of remembering some guy, obviously we all love firing up a baseball card, firing up a baseball reference page. You know, there are a million memes about it now of guys will just sit around and name 1990s ball players or whatever. I really do feel like
the guy that did that first post, you know, is like in Foxing. It's like a rock and roll dude. Yes.
He's
like
no idea,
which is amazing.
That's all I do on a tour bus.
Yeah. I think that that part of it was like really wholesome to me, like a band that I like, that I've seen perform. The idea of them driving across the country and one of the dudes just being like, do you remember Rafael Soriano? He was pretty good for a couple of years. Like, super. Love that.
Yeah, it's great. And like there are obviously different degrees of, and it's kind of like a memed thing now. But you are kind of like the spiritual father of this with the Deadspin era and now at Defector. What goes it like at the heart of this for you? Like, why is this such a core part? And we can do it for basketball and football too, but it really does seem like a baseball specific thing. Why has this become such a, like a core part of your, at least your public facing baseball fandom?
I mean, in some ways it's like, because I'm better at remembering relief pitchers from 10 years ago than I am at like calculating FIP or anything. Like, I don't, there's a lot of like baseball stuff that I have imposter syndrome about because I'm pretty much enumerate, you know, like
we're in a fantasy league together. I know where you are in the standings.
You know exactly where my limitations are. Like, I'm a real sixth, seventh place ass guy. But in this case, like, you never know what's going to sort of stick in your mind. And for me, I think it was like, as a kid, I collected baseball cards and that was like how I knew players. You know, I could only watch games on local television. So that was the Mets or the Yankees. And, you know, so a team, you know, you'd see the Mariners three times a year or six times a year, if that. And so most of the guys that were on that team, I would just sort of know as like a squinting, grimacing, sometimes smiling face on a baseball card in my home. And for whatever reason, that like made enough of an impression on me that I think that like, I'm like average with names in real life. Like if I met somebody once, there's a pretty good chance I'll remember their name the second time around. That doesn't explain why I like remember Adani Echevarria's name. Like I'm never going to meet him. It's not important, but it is the sort of thing where I think for whatever reason, that's like a big part of the baseball experience to me is like the churning through of guys who are like in that moment having, you know, the time of their lives, like living a dream, playing baseball, making money, traveling from city to city, and yet at the same time are not significant by any, you know, sort of real metric. There's like a sort of, I don't want to get too pretentious about it, but there's a literary aspect to it, you know, like
these are
a lot of stories.
And to go back to like Foxing being the guy who put that out there, it's like there's a little bit of like, okay, well, like I don't know if like Blink-182 did it. It's not as cool as being like, oh, yeah, I know the guy from Foxing. He did that. Like,
yep.
So I had brought up, so Baseball Reference has this wonderful tool where you can look up guys who played for multiple franchises. I brought up in prep for this guys who have played for the Jays and the Mets. It's like, yeah, everyone knows Carlos Delgado and Ricky Henderson and David Cone played for both of those teams. But you mentioned Adani Echevarria. I was a Jays prospect on the way up. You mentioned relief pitchers. I'm like, oh, I was on Scott Schoenweiss's Baseball Reference page today. Like those ones are more to the heart of what we're talking about here than, yeah, Carlos Delgado, probably a longtime favorite of both of us, but it's not the same thing as pulling like, you know, oh, I was remembering Frank Catalanato with a friend at work yesterday, another guy who played for both teams. Those are a little different. They hit different.
Yeah, I think that's and this is sort of like part of the fun of, I still do the Immaculate Grid basically every day. It's like my version of Sudoku or like one of those like Times word finding games that people play. Like, and a lot of it is like just the sort of, I think the Jays and the Mets have done kind of a lot of deals relative to other teams. There's teams where I've like sort of struggled even with the Mets to remember, you know, which, like how many guys have played for the Diamondbacks and the Mets, like not nearly as many. Whereas like with the Jays, it's like they have a relationship in some ways. I know it's just the professional thing, but the idea of like a GM being like, I'm done with my Darryl Siciliani. Do you need him? And then someone in Toronto be like, yeah, sure, whatever. Let's give it a shot. Like there's, I like the linkages that it creates between fan bases that way.
Yeah, it's a great one. Okay, last one for you, because we only got about 2 minutes left in the show. But you wrote a thing at Defector last October about the Diamondbacks. And within that, you kind of chuckle that, well, you write a lot of the baseball prospectus essays. You usually have one every year. And it's almost always, they almost always give you the team in crisis. Craig Goldstein's like, okay, this is my crisis guy. Do you think you're getting, so the last 2 years for the Blue Jays, it has been me and then our pal Steve Slodkowski of Pop. Do you think with the Jays coming off the season that they've had, you're getting the nod for next year?
No, honestly, like I was worried about it. I can tell you, you want me to exclusively reveal what team I'm going to write in the next? I have never done the A's, so I'm finally doing the A's. But it is like they've admitted as much to me because they make these decisions decently early, but also they make them with people in mind. There's a reason why you and Steve got the Jays. It's because you're like from Toronto and you care about them. The reason that they gave me the Marlins and I got them to admit this, the reason I've done the Angels twice is like, you know, this is going to make me mad. And Craig will be like, yeah, that's the whole idea. Yeah. We want to see how red you get.
The A's got their team stolen from them by a billionaire who can't even get public funding from the state of Nevada. Do you know how bad your business plan has to be?
The sphere
exists and you can't get money for a baseball team.
It's really incredible to think about. This is somehow like that they picked a team that's more depressing than the White Sox and gave it to me. Is you got to tip your cap to the guys at Baseball Prospectus. They're doing good work at making me upset.
Yeah, it's a great running bit, and I look forward to that essay. David, this is great. Got to let you go, man. Thank you for doing this.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me. See you.
David Roth of Defector Media. A lot of great stuff over there. Sometimes sports stuff. There was a great essay, by the way, from Michael Rosen of Fangraphs. I mentioned yesterday when we were talking to Ben Clemens, he went down to Sabre Seminar, and he was just talking about, you know, the community around baseball in an event like that. So Defector, in addition to being a great site overall, also some good sports stuff. And David's a longtime pal who I've never got to have on the show and talk baseball with because the Mets hadn't been that relevant and the timing didn't work out all that well. So that's it for today's show. We'll have a show as usual tomorrow. Keegan's going to be on. We'll talk. We'll do a bunch of stuff tomorrow. Katie Wu's going to come on. She covers the Cardinals and has done some national stuff at The Athletic. She's awesome. She's been on with us in the past. That'll be great. I think we'll also do a little more text line tomorrow than we've been doing lately. The reason that I've scaled it back a little bit is we've had such great guests. Amit Mann doing a great job booking the show. But also, like, a lot of the questions have been the same kind of questions over and over again. And that's not the fault of the people texting in. That's the fault of the Jays are in a part of the season where there's like only three things to talk about. But we'll do some more of that tomorrow. So get those ready. And yeah, I'll put the call out for them tomorrow. Thank you to Caitlin McGrath, to Jordan Schusterman, to Jeff Ponce, and to David Roth for joining us today. Thank you to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass as usual. There is no Toronto Blue Jays game tonight. Blair and Barker will still be with you 4 to 6 as usual. And then I will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to set you up for the weekend series with the Cardinals and all the races around Major League Baseball. Have a wonderful Thursday.